This is an AMI podcast.
Hey there, this is Kelly MacDonald, co-host of Kelly & Company on AMI Audio. On our show, we talk about the events and happenings that are relevant to the blind and partially sighted community across Canada. With the help of our regional contributors, we'll keep you up to date on what's happening in your community so you don't miss out. So give Kelly & Company a try and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Description Deep Dive, the James Bond Files, where we explore the visual world of 007. Here, we'll flesh out the characters, try on the costumes, toy with the gadgets, and slip through the sinister layers in all 25 official Bond films. I'm your describer and host, JJ Hunt. Welcome.
Yeah, baby! Yeah.
In our last episode, we described the Sean Connery era of 007. Connery was the first Bond in the franchise, the consummate 1960s British super spy who set the standard for all Bonds to come. But the 70s and early 80s were Roger Moore's time to shine. In this episode, we'll focus on his Bond films. Live and Let Die from 1973, The Man with the Golden Gun from 74, 1977's The Spy Who Loved Me, Moonraker, released in 1979, For Your Eyes Only from 1981, 1983's Octopussy, and finally, A View to a Kill, released in 1985. Oh, and remember that time when Connery came back to do an unofficial Bond movie, Never Say Never Again? Yeah, we'll talk about that one too. There are lots of tales about Bond actors being hired and fired, and as with any good spy story, it's tricky to separate truth from fiction. It's fair to say that Roger Moore was in the running for the part long before he booked it. It's possible that he was first considered for the role before Connery was cast, or maybe it was when Connery first left the series in 1967. Regardless, the reason producers wanted Moore for the role was the very same reason he couldn't accept it. His hit TV series, The Saint. The Saint was a British spy thriller that aired from 1962 to 1969 and starred Roger Moore as a suave, debonair man of mystery who battles bad guys between fashionable flings with beautiful women. Sound familiar? The show was a hit, and Moore was locked into a contract, so he had to wait for The Saint to end and Connery to step down a second time before he could move from TV to the movies and take over as Bond. Connery left the series in pretty decent shape. The Bond movies were still popular and profitable, and the formula was well established. In fact, some might say that the formula was getting to be a bit rigid. So with Moore stepping into the role, producers felt it was time to make some changes, some of which altered the look and feel of the franchise. We'll talk about that in a moment, but first, let's describe our new Bond, Roger Moore. In 1973, Roger Moore was a dashing, tall, fit man, neither muscular nor slight. He had dark brown hair, which may or may not have been all his, worn shorter at the sides and with a side part and sometimes swooping bangs. He had a wrinkled forehead, a full, round mole on his left cheek close to his nose, and bright blue eyes which he fixed on fellow actors with a steely gaze or a twinkling smile. His thin lips, dimpled chin, and square jaw were often held tight, but he regularly smirked, pulling a slight smile to one side, which left curving laugh lines on his left cheek. Moore was an avowed eyebrow actor, meaning his eyebrows did most of his acting. Moore once said that he only had three expressions as Bond: right eyebrow raised, left eyebrow raised, and eyebrows crossed when grabbed by jaws. His take on the character was quite different from his predecessors. Connery was charming, but his commanding presence came from his intensity and physical stature, which hinted at the violence his athletic body could inflict. Moore's commanding presence was related to his class and charm. Connery might have liked a good pun, but Moore's Bond was far more comedic and affable. Perhaps Moore himself summed up their differences best when he said that Sean played Bond as a killer, and I played Bond as a lover. Most of the supporting players from the Connery era made it through the Moore years, too. Q came back movie after movie, his comb-over getting thinner and his eyebrows bushier. The producers did leave him out of the first Moore film, Live and Let Die, in an effort to steer the franchise away from the trademark gadgets, but he was quickly brought back for the next outing in the series. Bernard Lee was back as M, from Live and Let Die through Moonraker. Despite an ongoing struggle with stomach cancer, he was scheduled to reprise the role in 1981's For Your Eyes Only. Sadly, he died before he could film his scenes. Out of respect, the producers opted not to recast the part right away, and instead rewrote the script, indicating that his character was away on leave. But every Bond needs an M, and for 1983's Octopussy, British actor Robert James Brown took the part and held it through the decade. Brown was a balding white man with downturned lips and thick, dark eyebrows, which were often knit, giving him a perpetual scowl. And of course, Miss Moneypenny remained at her desk in M's outer office, wherever his office popped up. While the Moore era lacked a single overarching nemesis like Blofeld from Spectre, it still had plenty of fantastic villains, like the man with the golden gun, Francisco Scaramanga, the world-renowned assassin with the third nipple, played by the wonderful Christopher Lee, whose voice is the very definition of
gravitas.
Lee had slicked back graying hair with a widow's peak, a long face, and sideburns down to his earlobes. He was a tall, thin man with hollow cheeks, uneven teeth, a hard stare, and a penchant for white linen suits with wide collars. Scaramanga's right-hand manservant was the delightful but deadly Knick-Knack, played by Hervé Villechaize, who would go on to play Tattoo on TV's Fantasy Island.
The plane! The plane!
Villechaize was under 4 feet tall and wore a formal servant suit with black tails and a bowler hat, like his predecessor Oddjob from Goldfinger. He had thick black hair, a round face with full features, and eyes that narrowed when he smiled. A View to a Kill featured another great villain team-up, with young Christopher Walken as Max Zorin and the multi-talented Grace Jones as Mayday. Walken had almond-shaped blue eyes with a slight bulge, a gap-toothed smile, and a helmet of slicked back hair that's just a bit too big and a bit too blonde. His partner Mayday is the Jamaican-born Grace Jones, a striking black woman with long muscular limbs, a flat-top haircut, and outrageous angular cheekbones. Her taut, dark-skinned body is showcased in a martial arts training scene in which she wears thigh-high leather boots and a black bodysuit cut extremely high on the hips. Jones was a bit of a pop culture phenomenon at the time. Her fierce physical presence and intensity was genuinely intimidating and gave her an air of what many referred to as masculinity, and it very much added to her undeniable sex appeal, even to a mainstream audience. She was unapologetically black, strong, and sexy, and not everyone knew what to do with that, a feeling that Moore conveys with a wide-eyed eye roll when Mayday gets into bed with Bond, flips him onto his back, and takes control of their encounter with a long, hard kiss. The most popular Bond henchman of the era, and I think it's fair to say of all time, is the one and only Jaws, played by Richard Kiel in both The Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker. Kiel was a massive 7'2" and had a broad chest, thick arms, and huge hands. He had a heavy brow, a strong round chin, and of course, a mouth full of interlocking steel teeth, which looked brutally uncomfortable to wear. Jaws was usually costumed in suits, including one with a powder blue jacket that was clearly pulled off a Hockey Night in Canada broadcaster in the early 1970s.
Oh, is he feisty! Oh, is he dangerous!
When he needed to get a job done, Jaws would strip off his sports coat and reveal old-fashioned suspenders, which arched over his thick chest and shoulders and crisscrossed his broad back. With a new actor hired to play their lead, Bond producers took the opportunity to ease off on some of the franchise tropes and shake things up a bit. One of the things they tried was putting their Bond in some new situations and settings. In Moore's first film, Live and Let Die, released in 1973, they left Q out of the script, served no martinis, stripped Bond of his tuxedo, and sent him to Harlem. 1973 was the height of the blaxploitation era, and to piggyback on the popularity of films like Shaft, the producers chose to adapt Ian Fleming's novel about a smuggler named Mr. Big who works out of a Harlem nightclub. The movie's Harlem scenes look much grittier than anything the franchise had filmed before. Maybe it's just the setting, but to my eye, it almost looks like the movie was shot with a different film stock. The colors don't pop like they do in the Technicolor 60s. They're a bit dull and grainy, making the Harlem scenes look like a 1970s TV cop show. In one skillfully shot scene, Bond is marched into a Harlem back alley at gunpoint. Grimy, gray brick buildings with iron fire escapes line both sides of the alley, blocking all hints of the sky. And the ground is littered with dirt and garbage and piles of debris. This obviously wasn't Bond's upper crust England, but neither was it the clean modern brutalism of Spectre. It marked a shift, both in story and design. The casting changed a bit too. Between Mr. Big's gang and scenes in Harlem, New Orleans, and the Caribbean, Live and Let Die featured more black actors than all previous Bond films combined. Bond is aided by junior agent Rosie Carver of the CIA, played by a stunningly fit black woman named Gloria Hendry, who covers her short natural hair with a larger afro wig. Carver was Bond's first black love interest, which was a genuine leap forward for the series. But the black men in Harlem are dressed in platform shoes, garish hats, and outrageous suits in patterns so loud you'd need ear protection if I described them in detail. Even for the 70s, the look is a bit more caricature than character. And in the Caribbean, during a voodoo ritual, a black man in a loincloth and animal skins unleashes a motionless rubber snake on a white man tied to a stake. So, not entirely progressive. By noting these changes, I don't mean to imply that the Bond series switches tracks altogether or takes on a dramatically different look or feel in the Moore years. Not at all. Live and Let Die ends in a standard underground lair, with Bond and Solitaire, played by petite young Jane Seymour, with her heart-shaped face and long, slender neck, hanging from a slow-death contraption belonging to Yaphet Kotto's Mr. Big. The Man with the Golden Gun features one of my favorite classic Bond locations, the private island with its natural limestone tower and secluded beach. The island's sole residence is a mansion built into the rocks. It's a modern 1970s dream with automated doors, computer controls, plush, cream-colored wall-to-wall carpeting, and a trippy carnival-themed shooting gallery with strobing lights and a life-or-death house of mirrors. In The Spy Who Loved Me, production designer Ken Adam came back to the series and added another layer to his resume. This time, it was an amphibious structure called Atlantis that looked like a giant metal four-legged spider with a bulbous body and big round eyes. The retro-futuristic architecture and elegant furnishings are a great mashup of set pieces and styles from previous Bond films, part European opulence, part modernist masterpiece. It's important to remember that in the Moore era, Bond had moved into the 1970s and 80s. From a design perspective, the franchise started as a response to staid 1950s conservatism by swinging through the 60s. But with Moore's run, we're into the individualism and casual chic of the 1970s, and then the computer tech and hyper-consumerism of the 1980s. it should be no surprise that the overall design, filmmaking, and even the refined sophistication of the Bond character would be affected by the styles and ideals of the day. Just consider the vehicles. Connery's Bond is most strongly associated with the Aston Martin DB5, which I described in the last episode. It's a luxury car with 1960s styling and timeless elegance. But Moore's most famous car is the Lotus Esprit S1. A bright white low-riding sports car with hard lines, hard angles, and a sharp pointed nose. Oh, and let's not forget that the wheels tuck into the body, horizontal slats cover the windows, and fins emerge from the covered wheel wells to transform it into a submarine. It's 007's Miami Vice car, and it screams high-tech new money. Rewatching these movies, I also found it interesting that by the 1980s, the Bond producers were well aware of their character's place in the greater pop culture landscape, and made several visual and audio allusions to other films moviegoers of the day would easily catch. In Moonraker, for example, the punch code to a secret lab plays the iconic five-note musical phrase from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And later in the film, Bond rides on horseback, dressed like Clint Eastwood, accompanied by the theme from The Magnificent Seven. Perhaps the most important thing I'm trying to convey about the Moore era is that the design isn't quite as singular as it was in the early films. In the Connery years, the styles, designs, and story elements were very strong and established the essential tone and tropes for the entire series moving forward. With the Moore era, the filmmakers treated those classic Bond elements like building blocks. But instead of only using blocks from the Bond set and just rearranging them to make more or less the same movie again and again, they began to add new blocks from different sets, adding design and story elements from goofball comedies, action films, gritty TV shows, and pop culture. Building blocks that were from the new era of 70s and 80s movie making. One of the really fun tone-setting elements of Bond movies are the opening credits. Generally, Bond enters the screen on our right and strides confidently toward the center, viewed from the inside of a spiral-cut gun barrel. He suddenly spins toward us, aims his own gun, and fires. Thick red blood drips down the screen. Then we get a teaser scene that takes us to the theme song and opening credits. Now, each credit sequence is unique, but there are some common elements that the directors play with: great music, trippy visual effects, and naked women. In the black-lit opening from A View to a Kill, Duran Duran hits us with a 1980s pop tune, while naked women with neon fingernails and glowing lipstick and body paint dance with handguns and ski naked in the dark, wearing nothing but strategically placed neon ribbons, which flap in the breeze. In The Spy Who Loved Me, Carly Simon sings the lovely ballad, "Nobody Does It Better," while naked silhouetted female gymnasts do cartwheels and flips, protected by silhouetted men in suits. In For Your Eyes Only, Sheena Easton sings for us, seemingly topless. Her purple and blue-tinted image fills the outlines of, you guessed it, naked silhouetted women, who in turn dance, spin, and swim across her image. The undisputed king of the Bond theme songs is Live and Let Die by Paul McCartney and Wings. Part soothing ballad, part rock opera climax, it's just a phenomenal epic theme song. As for the visuals, if the burning skulls and wide-eyed stares of a topless woman in a beaded necklace are a bit too much for you, just give it a minute. The naked, silhouetted dancing women are on their way. Despite the original idea to back off on the gadgets, the Moore years featured some great Q inventions. The ski pole gun from The Spy Who Loved Me, the teased umbrella with jaw-like spikes in For Your Eyes Only, the shark-inflating pellet gun from Live and Let Die, or the personal submarine disguised as a crocodile from Octopussy. And of course, there are the watches. Moore had tons of watches with gadget features. Magnetic field generators, buzz saws, teletype machines, dart guns, explosives, two-way radios, tracking devices, and TVs. Imagine a TV in a watch?
The Pocket TV by Casio.
Send check or money order for $99.95 to Casio Pocket TV.
Watches are a natural fit for James Bond, who likes fine things from caviar and wine to clothing and cars. And there's a genuine history of real-life spies using watches with onboard gadgets and hiding places. So they're the perfect product to tie into these movies. And that's exactly what these watches are. Product tie-ins. Every time you hear the audio description narrator tell you that Bond checks his watch or adjusts the gadget in his watch, keep in mind that the watch face is likely on screen in a close-up for several seconds. That's worth big money to the watchmakers, who both modify off-the-shelf products and release new designs in concert with the films. The audience gets to check out the silver digital Seiko while Bond reads the teletype strip, or admire the Rolex before Bond sets the tiny circular saw blade a-spinnin'. And the product placements aren't just reserved for the gadgets. Bond is filmed and photographed wearing luxury watches, diving watches, analog watches, digital watches, and all are available for sale at your local high-end retailer. In fact, many Bond actors have advertising contracts with the watch manufacturers directly. Omega has been the official watch of James Bond since 1995, and the Omega Diver 300M 007 edition is even advertised as having been developed with design input from current Bond Daniel Craig. There have been several rights and licensing tangles with the Bond novels over the years. But things got really goofy in the 1980s when some of the players from the early films won key legal battles and found themselves with the rights to make a second adaptation of the Ian Fleming novel, Thunderball. A hefty paycheck and a percentage of the box office lured Connery back to the role that made him famous for the 1983 film, Never Say Never Again, which was released within months of Moore's Octopussy. Joining him was a fantastic cast of soon-to-be stars like Kim Basinger, with her long blonde hair and feathered bangs, her porcelain complexion and her pale blue eyes, and Mr. Bean himself, Rowan Atkinson, who uses his jutting lower lip and thick arching eyebrows to create an endless string of Play-Doh expressions. And who could forget Max von Sydow's turn as Blofeld? He might have limited screen time, but with his gravelly, sinister voice and his silver goatee, he makes a delightful cat-stroking villain. The producers then lined up a very solid director, Irvin Kershner, who had recently directed Star Wars: The Empire Strikes Back. And the result is a pretty good spy movie, but it only sort of feels like a Bond movie. The regular supporting players aren't the Moneypenny and Q we know and love, and the cinematography is a bit inconsistent. Sometimes the film does capture the grandeur and the lush aesthetics of the classic Connery films, like the charity ball scene or Bond's time in the Bahamas. But there are moments when the audience is expecting an extraordinary set or a certain Bond aesthetic, and the visuals just fall flat. Like the underwhelming NATO council chamber, or the rather bland submarine. But for me, the biggest missing piece is the soundtrack. The James Bond theme is crucial to creating that 007 vibe. It's layered into the soundtrack multiple times in every other film, with different arrangements that match the era and motifs. From Russia with Love featured a punchy, jazzy theme, and in You Only Live Twice, it's a full orchestra version. For Live and Let Die, they used a funky arrangement to match the Blaxploitation vibe. And The Spy Who Loved Me includes a disco version called Bond 77. In a rather meta moment in Octopussy, the song is even used by a snake charmer to get Roger Moore's attention. But in Never Say Never Again? Nothing. They didn't have the rights to the theme song. Without that soundtrack, the entire film becomes kinda generic. Not bad, but not really Bond. Moore had a solid run as James Bond, filming 7 movies between 1973 and 1985. That's more official turns as 007 than any other actor before or since. And his final film, A View to a Kill, earned a respectable $152 million US at the box office worldwide, and had the biggest opening weekend for a Bond movie to date. But there was a serious concern. Roger Moore was 58 years old. Now, he was fit, he was handsome, and fans still liked him. But he had brown liver spots on his hands, his wrinkles were getting deeper, his skin was a bit less taut. In other words, he was starting to look his age. Now, that wouldn't necessarily have been a deal-breaker, except that Bond films, and let's face it, Hollywood in general, are hooked on beautiful young women. And having a leading man who looked like the 60-year-old he almost was, chasing all those very young women, well, it was a bit creepy. The age discrepancy between Bonds and their love interests is a perpetual issue. In 2015, the Irish Examiner ran a piece that included a bit of math on the subject. At that time, the average age difference between Bond and his lovers was 14.2 years. And the Moore era was the worst. In For Your Eyes Only, a young figure skater named B.B. Dahl has the hots for Roger Moore's Bond. But the actress they cast, Lynn Holly Johnson, was 30 years younger than Moore. In A View to a Kill, when Moore meets Allison Duty's Jenny Flex, who's dressed in a formal riding outfit, a black fitted coat, tight white pants, and knee-high leather boots, they exchange some flirty banter about spending a lot of time in the saddle and enjoying an early ride. He was 58. She was 19. And they both looked it. So the producers had two options. Start casting women who were closer in age to Moore, or get a new Bond. Ladies and gentlemen, meet 41-year-old Timothy Dalton. Description Deep Dive, The James Bond Files, is written, recorded, and produced by me, JJ Hunt, with production assistance from Sam Robinson. Thanks to AMI's Media Accessibility Services team, as well as Andrew Morris, for their support. The manager of AMI Audio is Andy Frank. If you're enjoying this deep dive into audio description, we'd love to hear about it. You can find us on Twitter at AMI Audio or hit me up directly at HeyHeyDoubleJ. In our next episode, we're going to break down the visuals from the 2 Timothy Dalton Bond films and the 4 starring Pierce Brosnan that will round out the 80s, take us all the way through the 90s, and lead us and Bond into the next century. Until then, my friends.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.